Welcome to All Sides with Anna Staper. How much money would you consider payment for the lives of Ohioans derailed by opioid addiction? $1 billion? $2 billion? Ohio will receive about $2 billion from companies involved with the making and marketing of prescription opioids. It's part of a national settlement with these companies, and there is no shortage of opinions on who should get the money. How we spend those dollars will shape addiction treatment and prevention efforts for years to come. So we're asking questions like, should the money go to addiction treatment, support for families, help raising the children left behind, reentry programs, law enforcement, Narcan? Anira Patani is a senior correspondent at KFF Health News, a national nonprofit covering U.S. healthcare issues. And she's been covering how the opioid settlements are going out in all states. Welcome to All Sides, Anari.
Thanks for having me.
Let's start with some background. Where does these billions of dollars come from?
So they're coming from actually more than a dozen different healthcare-related companies, companies that made prescription opioid painkillers, that distributed them, retail pharmacies like your CVS, Walgreens. Basically, a lot of these companies were sued by cities, counties, and states for the fact that they distributed these painkillers and sold them as not being addictive when they in fact were. And so the companies, rather than go through all the different lawsuits, decided to settle. And now collectively, they're going to be paying more than $50 billion over nearly two decades to state and local governments.
And Ohio is getting about $2 billion. Now, contextually, that's more than states of similar sizes are getting. So why are we getting more?
So part of the calculation, the formula used to calculate how much each state would get, tries to take into account the level of harm and the damage done. So what percentage of the population suffers from an opioid use disorder? What percentage do they contribute to overdose deaths in the country? And so Ohio, Pennsylvania, some of the states that were really hard hit by the crisis are going to see more as a way to try to address that.
So unfortunately, it's because we have more people struggling with opioid addiction. We have a higher percentage of people dying from overdoses.
Right. There's a greater need. And the idea with this money is that it's supposed to be used to address that need, to try to mitigate the problem. And so hopefully the places that are harder hit are getting a little bit more so that they can make more of a difference.
So this summer, the U.S. Supreme Court struck down a bankruptcy plan from Purdue Pharma, the maker of OxyContin. How does that figure into all of this?
So that's one slice of this. It's an important one because obviously Purdue Pharma, the Sackler family, is synonymous with the opioid crisis, but it is just one of the companies. So I'll give you the recap, but I always like people to know that there is still money coming from other companies. A lot can be done on this issue. But what happened with Purdue Pharma is that, you know, the company filed for bankruptcy because of all the lawsuits it was facing. And as part of the bankruptcy deal, the Sackler family offered to pay some of their own personal money into the company's settlement with victims of the opioid crisis. But in exchange, what the family wanted was immunity from future civil lawsuits, even though they weren't filing for bankruptcy themselves as individuals. And what the Supreme Court essentially said is, that's not allowed. You can't get bankruptcy protections without actually filing for bankruptcy yourself. That would be like, you know, having your cake and eating it too. So now they're kind of all the parties in that deal are back to the negotiating table to figure out what a new deal could look like. So Purdue money is not flowing yet, but all those other companies we talked about are already paying.
And it's flowing over time, right? We're not getting a lump sum of $2 billion. That's going to be paid out over the coming decades.
That's correct. So payments started late 2023 or late 2022, early 2023, but are going to be coming annually through 2038.
So now let's talk a little bit about how it's structured here in Ohio, because Ohio has put in place is something called One Ohio Recovery Foundation, and it's different from what other states have done.
Yeah, Ohio is interesting because it is so. Let me preface this with every state has split up who's handling their opioid settlement money kind of differently. Some amount goes to county governments and cities. Some amount is controlled by the state. Ohio is interesting because it is one of only two states, the other one is West Virginia, that chose to create a private nonprofit foundation to control a bulk of the money. So in Ohio, that's the One Ohio Recovery Foundation. It controls 55% of all the settlement funds that come into the state. And the idea in creating this sort of private nonprofit was that it was a way to learn from the history of the tobacco settlement. When the tobacco settlement money came in the 90s, a lot of it got used by government officials on their pet projects. And basically, this was supposed to be a way to move control outside of the government to a private entity that wouldn't be influenced by those factors. However, I will say, as the One Ohio Recovery Foundation has rolled out, some people in the state have raised concerns that a lot of their board is dominated by government elected officials. So it's unclear how much separation there really is.
We're going to be hearing from the One Ohio Recovery Board later this hour. And we also want to hear from you. Do you have a family member who's been affected by opioid addiction? Do you have opinions on how these billions of dollars should be spent here in Ohio? You can give us a call at 614-292-8513, or you can email your comments to allsides@wosu.org. I want to talk a little bit more about One Ohio Recovery, but first I want to play an audio clip from Ohio Governor Mike DeWine because he was really pushing this private nonprofit idea.
So by setting up a nonprofit with a specific goal to deal with these problems, we're assured that that settlement money is in fact going to go towards this problem.
But like you said, there has been some questions, specifically around open meeting laws, public records. There was a case that went all the way to the Ohio Supreme Court saying when Ohio was covered by public record laws and must make them available to the public. Then the governor changed that, saying that they weren't required to meet these terms. So it's been a lot of back and forth on what exactly One Ohio is.
I think there's been a lot of contention in Ohio around this. And as someone who's sort of covering the opioid settlement landscape nationally, I think Ohio is one of the places where people have raised the most concerns around transparency. Is, the One Ohio Foundation, are their meetings open to the public? They are now, but the public still cannot comment at those meetings. So they can't engage in the way that some people would like to. Like you said, are they subject to public records law? There was a lawsuit, but then there was a reversal. And so I think, there is a lot of concern because people want to be involved with this money. So many families I've talked to consider it blood money. People died for it. And so they feel a very personal connection to it and want to be able to see how it's being used, be heard in the process. And sometimes they don't feel that's the case.
Yeah, there's also been questions about that board and a lack of diversity on the board, not only in terms of racial diversity, but in terms of whether people on the board, like that, whether we had somebody who has survived opioid addiction and come out the other side, whether their perspective is represented on this board.
I think these are concerns that I'm hearing across the country because the people who are affected by this problem, people who are dealing with opioid addiction, people who are in recovery, family members who have lost people, often they know the pitfalls in the current system, right? They know what didn't work that led to their terrible outcome. And these are people who a lot of times want to be involved with this money to address those very pitfalls, to make sure that other families don't experience what they did. And so there's conversations about, well, if these are the people who know the system most intimately and who know what needs to be fixed, shouldn't they be in positions to decide where this money goes or influence where the money goes? But a lot of times the way these boards are created are it's more about, government officials or doctors or other folks who also bring really important perspectives. But I think the conversation in Ohio and elsewhere you're hearing is we are missing some key perspectives.
Is West Virginia set up just like us, or is it a little bit different down there?
It's set up similarly in that they have a private nonprofit foundation created solely for this. They have a board for that foundation. The board has statewide representatives as well as regional representatives, exactly like Ohio does. The number of representatives is different. And they have not, West Virginia is a little bit behind where Ohio is. They haven't really started giving out money yet. The One Ohio Recovery Foundation just gave out last week a first round of about $2 million in grants. So we have yet to see how West Virginia plays out, but the setup is quite similar.
Yeah, and one of the things that if people are looking at the timeline and are a little confused It's been a few years since these settlements were negotiated. Now, we talked about how the Sackler family, that's still sort of being negotiated. But it took, what, almost 18 months from settlement to first grants here in Ohio?
Yeah, it has been a slow process in Ohio, in a lot of the country, honestly, because I think the settlement, the largest settlement deal, was finalized in February of 2022. Now, money didn't start flowing for quite some time after that. But I think a lot of places didn't really figure out the structure of who was going to deal with the money and how they were going to get it out until the money started arriving. So you have money starting to flow, and then people setting up like, oh, we need a board. Who's going to sit on the board? How are we going to elect the board? Now the board is elected. How do we set up processes? They need a bank account. They need, you know, a communications person. So all that infrastructure took time to build. And a lot of places, when I talk to government officials or the folks in charge of this money, they will say, you know, we understand the urgency, but they want to set up a good, solid process. Because as we talked about, the money's going to keep coming for many years. And so if you start off with a good, solid process, then hopefully that can be used in future years.
Yeah, we also hear a lot about those tobacco settlements as cautionary tales, because a lot of times they put them into the general revenue fund rather than towards smoking cessation.
Yeah, the tobacco money got used for all sorts of things. In North Carolina, South Carolina, it even got used to subsidize tobacco farmers.
Oh.
So people, yep. So
that feels weird.
People really don't want to see a repeat of that. I think people are invested in this money and making sure it's used properly. There's still a lot of questions about what properly means, depending on who you ask. But I think there is a sense of we need to do better this time.
Yeah, we're going to get into that later, whether properly means law enforcement, whether it means needle exchange, whether it means fentanyl testing strips, drug treatment programs. There are a lot of ideas.
Yes, no shortage of those.
One good bit of news, though, that we've seen recently is overdose deaths in the country have fallen from previous years. In Ohio, it fell by nearly one third in 2024. Do we have any sense of what factors are driving this downward trend?
The short answer is not really. No one is quite sure. I mean, it's certainly good news. Like you said, great drop in Ohio. Nationwide, the CDC says there's like a 10 to 12% decline in overdose deaths since last year. And that's coming after years of increases. So it's really heartening. But I think right now people are just kind of putting out hypotheses like, hey, maybe we've distributed more naloxone, which is the generic name of Narcan. And so it's also been made over the counter. Maybe that's helping decrease the deaths. Some people have said, you know, the Mexican cartels have had some disruptions. Maybe they're shipping less fentanyl to the U.S. There's also sort of a more sad sort of hypothesis, which is that since there have been so many record breaking years of overdose deaths, the population at risk has decreased, and the folks who have survived have built tolerance and learned their tolerance with these drugs. So there are a lot of potential thoughts out there. I think until we have more years and a lot more research to see this decline, we won't really know what's behind it.
We've also over the years gotten a lot more strict about how these kinds of medications get prescribed in the first place.
That is definitely true. But I will say in terms of the overdose deaths in the past decade and a half, let's say, are mostly driven by illicit drugs. In the 90s, they were started by the prescribed opioids, and we saw that spike. Over time, that has really transitioned to heroin and fentanyl. And so though prescribing numbers have come down, most researchers don't think that's the reason that we're seeing a decline in overdose deaths now.
So going forward, as you continue to follow how the money flows out into all these different programs, what are you hearing from officials about what success will look like? What will make them, you know, look back and say, hey, we did this right. This didn't end up like the tobacco money.
I think this is such a great question, but it's something that when I speak to a lot of folks in charge of the money, they're just starting to think about that. There are just so many logistical questions that they start off with when the money started flowing. And now, you know, they have grant processes and they're starting to give it out. And now this question is starting to come in as like, how do we know if these grants are effective? We granted money out for 3 years. after that, should we renew them? Was that a good idea? Was this program working? So I think big picture, a lot of people want to see a continued decrease in the overdose death rates, in the non-fatal overdose rates. A lot of people also want to see a decrease in the population of people using drugs, using illicit drugs. And they say, some of that comes from the prevention end too. You save lives, you get people into treatment, but also can we prevent more people from starting to use drugs? So I think that's what folks are looking at.
That was Inari Patani, senior correspondent for KFF Health News. Thank you for your time today.
Thanks so much for having me.
Coming up, we're going to hear from the executive director of One Ohio Recovery Foundation, who will explain who got the first grants and why. That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
The candidates for November are set.
I know Donald Trump's tight.
Between now and Election Day.
We are not going back.
A campaign season unfolding faster.
Kamala Harris is not getting a promotion.
Than any in recent history.
Make America great again.
Follow it all with new episodes every weekday on the NPR Politics Podcast.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Anna Stever. More than 3,000 Ohioans died of an opioid death last year. We've been one of the hardest hit states by the epidemic, and as a result, we're getting about $2 billion from pharmaceutical companies over the next 18 years. To dole out this money, Ohio created a private nonprofit called the One Ohio Recovery Foundation. It divided the state into regions and is governed by a board. The foundation announced its first grant recipients earlier this month, and the executive director of One Ohio, Alicia Nelson, joins us now. Welcome to All Sides, Director.
Hello. Thank you. Thanks for having me.
The foundation was created in December of 2021, and you get to distribute 55%, so about half of the money that's going to come in. So first, let's just say who gets the rest of the money?
Sure. So we get the 55%, as you said. The remainder go to the communities direct through. Well, the remainder 30% goes to the communities directly in checks to local community commissioners, mayors, townships. They are really on the ground putting these funds to use right now. The remainder then after that 30% goes to 15% goes to the state of Ohio.
And so the foundation at its October 9th meeting announced 18 initial grants to these organizations totaling $2.1 million. You also gave preliminary approval for another 100 grants or so totaling more than $22 million. So it sounds like you got a lot of ideas in the pipeline.
That is certainly right. It's truly an exciting time to be at the foundation. I know this has been long awaited for the community organizations to be partners with us, but we're really proud and really to be launching into telling all of you who we're partnering with has been an exciting part of the process, too. So as you said, last Wednesday, we announced the first few. But as you also said, hundreds more are coming in the coming weeks.
So I am going to ask you a difficult question. How did you determine who gets to go first?
Well, it was all timing. There was no favorites kind of played in the process. So with our process, we really wanted to do what is called participatory grant making here in Ohio. Really leaning into what do communities need and making sure those community voices were a part of the decision-making process. So they all received their grant applications that they needed to review. They all being the regions, the 19 regions that we have here in Ohio, received their grant applications sometime in May and June. And whoever was done first is kind of who is awarding first in that process.
So it's kind of first come, first serve.
It was first come, first serve. Yep.
So that may answer my next question, which is Region 5 received the most. Can you tell us what area of the state that covers?
Region 5 for our first grant announcements is Summit County. They had the first, the most in that first announcement because they had a number of grants that they fully funded. And so it wasn't any real science to it. Those fully funded grants are easier to process through our system. And so there's not a lot of negotiation that needed to go back and forth between the recipients. So Region 5 put, Summit County put forth the most this round, but you'll see that it'll balance out as we continue to do our grant award Wednesdays, which we hope to do as quickly as we, as many as we can in the coming weeks over the next couple months.
Yeah, Franklin County is Region 1 for those who are listening, and doesn't look like we got any awards this go around.
This first go around, but like I said, we will be announcing them as soon as we can. We really are working the process a little differently than I've been involved in. We wanted to talk to the grantees, so many recipients across the state know that they're being funded through this round of funds, but we wanted to make sure that they felt comfortable with what the region adjustments may be. Some receive half of what they asked for. Some received a quarter of what they asked for. And so we want to make sure that they feel good about what they're going to receive before we announce them to the public, and that process be more clear for them before we kind of tell the world the exciting work that they're going to do.
Let's talk about some of them. Now, we're going to be hearing from one of the grant recipients in the next segment, but let's talk about some of the different services, because they're all different.
That's right.
The largest grant went to the Summit Recovery Hub. What is the Summit Recovery Hub?
Well, you know, most of our grants, as you'll see as in the coming weeks, are going to go to recovery supports and prevention. Those are areas that are typically, maybe seen as underfunded or non-reimbursable supports that are really important for people on their recovery journey. The Summit Recovery Hub is an example of that, those recovery support services. So run by someone in recovery themselves who is going to support others in the community to really make sure that they can stay on that path to long-term recovery. So we're really proud of that partnership.
We have another large grant for the Wood County Children's Services Association. Is this support for children of parents who struggle with addiction?
That has certainly been, something that we really wanted to focus on. We know that so many kids have been impacted by this, and they're, you know, being raised by grandparents, aunts, and uncles. And so support for programs that are addressing the needs of those kiddos and their families are going to be, you know, high priority, and it clearly will be evident in what we fund this first round.
Yeah, sometimes they may have lived through certain trauma, seeing their parents in the throes of addiction. They need a lot of wraparound services.
That's right. And to lose a parent for any reason is hard.
Oh, yeah.
And like you said, when you're dealing with a disease like substance use disorder, there is some other outlining, you know, trauma that can come up with that. And we want to be able to support those kiddos and their families to move forward.
Everything from food insecurity to housing insecurity to parents just not being around sometimes for days at a time. Like it's really hard actually to think about kids growing up in those environments.
Absolutely.
You also had another grant for the Hardin County Domestic Relations Court. Why a domestic relations court?
Well, that particular court and courts across the state have been, you know, really stepping up in understanding what they're seeing in their courtroom is not necessarily a symptom of someone wanting to do harm or break laws, but it could be a substance use disorder that is, you know, tearing families apart. It could be that substance use disorder in the activities that surround substance use disorder at times that can land someone in a courtroom. And so those community courts that are really looking more holistically at the problem and keeping folks from, let's say, incarceration, but back with their families, supporting their work to get back to work, and all those other kind of drug court related activities are going to be necessary. We don't want to see
diversion courts.
Yeah, we don't want to see more folks incarcerated per se. We want folks to really find the treatment and support that they need. And so those communities that are doing those types of programs are going to be key.
You're listening to All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking this hour about the opioid settlements and the $2 billion Ohio will be receiving in the coming decades. We still want to hear from you this hour. If you have a family member or a friend who's been touched by opioid addiction, if you have ideas about how this $2 billion should be spent, you can give us a call at 614-292-8513 or email allsides@wosu.org. How does the history of the tobacco settlement and the way that money was spent or perhaps mismanaged hover over the decisions made in this settlement?
I think it was very impactful for the folks who really sat down at the table in the beginning to write the Memorandum of Understanding, which we call the One Ohio MOU. We knew that there was lessons to be learned from the tobacco settlement. And one of the major lessons was, you know, without some sort of guardrails, these funds could be used in ways that the settlements did not intend. And so the few guardrails that were set up were, one, the creation of the foundation, 55% of every dollar come into the foundation. And our whole purpose is to, you know, really address this issue and really look to solutions around this issue. The second way that we were really focused on protecting these funds is 100% of the funds have to be used for approved purposes and cannot be diverted in that way, you know, long term for anything outside of the approved purposes.
There have been some criticisms of the board makeup, not only in terms of racial diversity, but in terms of whether people whose family members have died of addiction or people in recovery themselves are participating. What is your response to people who have concerns about the voices on the board themselves?
No, I definitely hear that concern, and it's something that we continue to work towards. As a Black woman, I understand that we need to be, you know, really thinking about diversity in a number of ways, not only racial diversity, economic diversity, geographic diversity. Our state is a microcosm of the United States. We have the hills of Appalachia all the way to our urban cores, and we all experience Ohio a little differently. And so we need to really make note of that. And I think that that's why that 19 region structure was created, to make sure that those needs, those uniqueness aspects of who we are as a community and as individuals is heard on that. We have work to do to continue to grow who is on those community organ or those community regional boards, who's on our board, and we are working to do that. I think the first round was so new that many didn't know, but as we look at 2025, we will have new opportunities for volunteers to come and join us in these discussions. We really do want that community voice, and so we're excited to welcome more to our umbrella that continues to grow.
That leads into my next question, which is your meetings are public, but there's been some questions about how public can give testimony, comments. How can members of the public get a hold of you guys or communicate their concerns, their wishes, their needs?
Certainly. So there's a number of ways that we can do that. And so our website has info@oneohiofoundation.com. We read those and really have listened to what the community has asked of us thus far. And we'll look to continue to bring more of those community voices to the table. We've encouraged not only folks to come to our public meetings, but in our regional meetings, there is space and opportunity for them to not only share their experience. Those meetings are all public and posted on our website as well. But go to those meetings as well. Share your experience in that those local community settings as well as at our board. And we'll continue to look for ways to really, you know, emphasize those opinions at different meetings.
At your recent meeting, you had a presentation by the Nationwide Foundation that highlighted its Beat the Stigma campaign, which is reducing stigma associated with substance use disorders. How important is that to the work that you're doing?
I think it's important on so many levels. One, it was an important for us as a foundation to see how other foundations in the state have really leaned into this. We're not alone when we think about what needs to be done and how to do it. And so one of the things that we've been really trying to lean into is who are our partners in the funding space and how do we make sure that we're not duplicating efforts? I think that, you know, the Nationwide Foundation has done a tremendous job, you know, looking at what do I do well and how can I use that to the community's benefit. And that Beat the Stigma campaign, it's hard to find someone who hasn't seen it. And the results from that are what we heard at the board meeting, very impressive. And so I think from that foundation perspective, that was important for us to hear. But two, stigma is an important issue. We still know that there are many who need treatment, who may be in some early onset years of maybe a developing substance use disorder and aren't seeking the treatment that they need. And so that stigma is still a very important factor of even if we make all of this new programs and services available, if folks aren't taking advantage of them or maybe too afraid to come and seek that support, they're definitely some issues with that. And so dealing with stigma and understanding the foundation aspects was really our need to bring them to the meeting.
I want to take a call from Leah in Columbus. Welcome to All Sides, Leah.
Oh, hi, Anna. I'm really happy that you took my call. I wanted to comment that while I think that the opioid settlement money is a great start, I think one of our challenges is that we're not approaching it in a holistic fashion. We're still approaching this on a piecemeal fashion where we make differences between opioid addiction and alcoholism when in fact they are really the same disease. They do have different treatments. But I think that what we really need is a federal act that is equal to the Ryan White CARE Act that happened in 96 for HIV funding. That act now funds all HIV work in the states, and it funds multiple levels for stigma, for prevention, for community service agencies, for mental health, for primary care. It was necessary to actually be able to approach HIV in a holistic function in order to decrease the stigma. And it's aware that, like HIV, addiction is a long-term condition that needs to be approached on multiple levels for different ages, for different groups, and it needs to be able to actually provide that treatment in an unbiased and caring way in order to actually move the needle on HIV. And we need that for addiction.
Thanks, Leah. You know, I think she makes a good point. This money is a settlement with the pharmaceutical companies, but we could always use more money to really think about, okay, how, actually, because if you think about HIV, it was a death sentence a couple decades ago, and now it's a chronic disease you can manage.
That's right. And I agree. I think one of the things that is important that is contrary to some of the federal funds that have come in the past that is different with these settlement funds is it does talk about all substance use disorders. So we do not have to be opioid specific with the settlement funds, and we have not been opiate specific even with our first round of grants. I do think we still have more to do, more to learn to really be that holistic partner that I think she's speaking to. And I think we're all as a country trying to figure out the best ways to do that because this is such a far-reaching disease and has so many kind of tentacles is what I've heard folks refer to them as that reach into, you know, the criminal legal system, into the schools, into the hospitals, into so many different areas that haven't, you know, really figured out the best ways to work together. And that is one of the things that we want to bring folks together to do at our region level and at our foundation level, is to have those holistic conversations. And so love to have more feedback on how to do that right, because it's not easy, but I think we're finding ways to integrate healthcare. We're finding ways to do things differently, and we're learning a lot from the people who need the care.
Final question. I know you've just started giving out the grant money, but are you starting to think about what success is going to look like for you? When all the money is given out, what's going to make you look back and say, I think we made the right choices?
We've definitely thought about it a lot. And I think that there's probably short and mid and long term responses that I could give you. But as a person who, you know, has experienced this really close, and not necessarily, you know, I'm not in recovery, but so many of my friends and family are. I want us to really have been a game changer. And we really are thinking about what we can do to catapult that. I know the money that we have talked about seems like a lot, but in a state as big as Ohio and as many people that need help, we're going to have to be more than money. We really are going to have to think about this, as the guest said, holistically. And we want to be the catalyst to bring that discussion together and bring folks together on not just money, but impact and outcomes. And so we definitely want to drive death down. We want to make sure that those have been impacted. You know, the children, as we talked about earlier, have a future that they feel hope about. And so much more. And so I think we're still noodling around on what do you do to be a game changer when there's so many people involved, but we're going to give it a try and figure out what that could look like for us.
That was the executive director of One Ohio, Alicia Nelson. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Coming up, two organizations that applied for grant share money and how that process played out. That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
The candidates for November are set.
I know Donald Trump's tight.
Between now and Election Day.
We are not going back.
A campaign season unfolding faster.
Kamala Harris is not getting a promotion.
Than any in recent history.
Make America great again.
Follow it all with new episodes every weekday on the NPR Politics Podcast.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Anna Staver. When it comes to treating opioid addiction, the needs are great. There are costs to getting sober, maintaining sobriety, taking care of the children impacted by addiction. We're talking this hour about how Ohio is beginning to spend more than $2 billion in drug settlement money, money that's going to flow into the state over the next 18 years. We've heard from One Ohio Recovery Foundation, which is getting about half of that money and sending it out. Now we're going to hear from organizations that applied to get those dollars. First is Jess Rist. She's the Chief Operating Officer for IBH, Addiction Recovery in Akron. Her organization received $75,000 in this first round of funding. Welcome to All Sides, Jess.
Welcome. Thank you so much for having me. It's an honor to be here today.
So success in recovery often hinge on what happens after you get sober. There are stumbles and sometimes there are relapses. But one constant is post-recovery programs, like your Reach Aftercare program. Can you tell us a little bit about it and how this 75 grand will help?
Yes, and absolutely. So the time that an individual spends in treatment is brief in comparison to the years of aftercare that follow. And so it's really critical for individuals to connect with aftercare resources or continuing care to maintain their recovery. And so we realized that about 10 years ago, and we launched our IBH Reach Aftercare program. And this is a completely voluntary program for any individual who completes any level of care at IBH Addiction Recovery. And it's really focused on connection to continued services, peer support, and creating a sober support network. And one focus point for our IBH Reach program participants is giving back to the community. And so our Reach participants will go out and volunteer at a ton of different organizations. So they might be at a food pantry on Monday, doing a community cleanup on a Tuesday, giving out Greek wraps at a Greek festival on Wednesday. So they're really just getting out into the community and volunteering as much as possible. And that has been critical and a huge part of their recovery. And so we applied for $75,000 for this to support this program because it keeps growing. And as individuals are completing treatment, they are craving this connection to continued care. And so this funding is going to be really important, for us to be able to provide this program to our clients.
Can I ask what the application process was like, what you thought of it moving through?
Absolutely. So I've been writing grants for many years now, and this was a very robust application, which I really appreciated. One of my favorite parts was that One Ohio Recovery Foundation wanted every applicant to show how the program or project you wanted to implement is evidence-based. So, meaning that there is research backing what you are proposing to do. And so I really loved that, although it was a ton of work. I think it showed that they were doing their due diligence to make sure that, the right programs were being funded.
So the number of opioid overdoses has declined here in Ohio and nationally. Does that give you hope that maybe we're starting to turn the corner on this?
It does. Any increase or any decrease is a win in my book. But still, that number was 228 last year. That's still too many. So while it is decreasing and we do have hope, we want to see that number at zero.
What would you want listeners to know about opioid addiction, opioid recovery, and Ohio's response to it?
Sure. So the first thing is to beat the stigma of addiction. It's okay to not be okay. And there are more people struggling in our communities than we might even be aware of. And so the more that we talk about this, the more that we connect people to resources, the better off we're going to be as a community. And so my number one thing that I want listeners to know is talk about it. Talk to your friends, talk to your colleagues, your family members, and help them find the resources and tools that they need to recover from their addiction. And then the second thing is that I have full faith in our county and state leadership to address this epidemic. And the work that they've done so far shows that they are committed to helping our communities.
I know you're based in Akron, but we have listeners all over the state through the Ohio Channel, through our app, through the website. So, Jess, I wanted to ask real quick, how do people find out more about IBH Addiction Recovery, about the Reach Aftercare program? How could somebody get involved?
Sure. So if you visit our website, it's www.ibh.org. We're also on social media, and you can learn more about our programs and services that way. And also, you can reach out to me anytime. I'd love to have you take a tour of our campus. We've got a beautiful 80-acre campus in Akron, and just really want to get people out on campus to see what we're all about.
That was Jess Rist, Chief Operating Officer for IBH Addiction Recovery in Akron. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
I want to turn to Yvonka Hall. She's the Executive Director of the Northeast Ohio Black Health Coalition. It's part of the Ohio Partnership of Families Impacted by Opioids, and she chairs the partnership. Welcome to All Sides, Yvonka.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
So the partnership applied for grants in all 19 regions of the state seeking emergency aid for rent, bills, childcare, other necessities. You haven't been notified of a grant award as of yet, though. Is that correct?
We have not been notified of a grant, but I think it's important also, we've talked about the application that we've applied, but I think for people to know who we are. So the Ohio Partnership for Family Impacted by Opiates, our vision for us is to ensure the legacy of hope and security for Ohio families impacted by the opiate crisis. And so that's why all of these families and organizations came together in the first place. For us, our mission is to support a collaborative family approach that strengthens, empowers, and uplifts Ohio communities that have been impacted by the historical, the current, and future opiate crisis by advocating at the local, state, and federal levels to leverage opiate settlement dollars. And so that's why it's important for us to to come together and apply for the funds, because for us, our guiding principles are to educate community members and legislators on the opiate crisis, to advocate for impacted families, to have a seat at the decision-making table. It's important for us to make sure that families that have been impacted have a seat at the table. And we want to promote awareness of the healing for families devastated by the opiate crisis in the state of Ohio. And we want to ensure that Ohio families are not alone in dealing with the opiate crisis. And so I think that that's why it's so important to know not only that we exist, but that we apply for the dollars in order for us to be able to continue to do the work that many of us have already been doing unfunded.
So when we had the director of One Ohio Recovery Foundation on a little bit earlier, Alicia said that there are more than 100 grants being processed. Hopefully we'll get them out in the next couple of weeks. Are you hopeful that you may be among them?
You know, I am very hopeful that we would not be overlooked. The fact that we are a family-focused entity that has come together to address the grave issues that disproportionately impact families that have been impacted by the opiate crisis. For us, our goal is to seek 10 to 20% of the opiate settlement dollars in each region that it should go to impacted families, because impacted families understand what's going on with the crisis. They understand where the ebbs and flows are. We understand around the focus around equity and meeting impacted families where they are in their journey, because everybody's at a different point in this. And so, and that's one of the reasons why we talked about historical harms. We talked about current and future. And so hopefully, you know, these dollars, hopefully, you know, all of our regions that have applied will receive the funding that they need in order for them to continue the work to address the issues that are disproportionately impacting families.
Yeah. And I also think families have such different economic resources when dealing with an addiction. Some of the stuff that you're asking money for is food assistance, rental assistance, but also birth certificates. Can I ask why birth certificates?
Well, many times. So what happens is if you lost a parent or so now you have a kinship family that's taking over a child, they may be on a limited or fixed income. And now you have a child that you need their birth certificate in order for you to get them the resources that they need. And so many children are coming to either their grandparents or other family caregivers with absolutely nothing. And so for me, the importance is that even though it wasn't the opiate crisis, for me, that's how I came to my grandparents. We came to my grandparents with absolutely nothing at 6 years old. And so it was up to my grandparents to use their meager income in order for them to provide the necessary things that we needed in order for us to thrive. And so think about, you know, you get a call that someone has died, your child, and your child has children. And now the children still need everything that they needed the day before. And so the needs are even greater because they also may have some trauma where they have dealt with some ACEs because of the things that they have lived through. And so making sure that we are empowering and uplifting families who have been impacted and making sure that children, you know, receive the things they need is vitally important because, you know, grandparents know, besides making sure that they have a roof over their head, that they have food, birth certificates, I mean, those things may sound basic, but those things are an added expense. And so when you are on a fixed income, any little expense can end up being
will put you over the edge.
Yeah. And for many people that are already impoverished, it can make you be homeless.
Yeah, that was Ivanka Hall, Executive Director of the Northeast Ohio Black Health Coalition. Thank you for your time today.
Thank you.
And thank you all for listening to All Sides on 89.7 NPR News.